Hail, fellow, well met. It's Jim Brown here again with another Capercast. This is number 28. And I'm told that after all the stories I've been telling, that some of you folks would like to hear some more seasteading stuff, like, how can you pull it off these days? That is, cruising on a budget, say, even the kind of budget that requires one to stop and work here and there. And the initial planning, let's say you're going to build your own boat, or even if you're just going to buy it, you got to have enough money left over to go someplace when you're done. And what sort of boat is that, if you buy it or if you build it? And if you're starting out as a real lubber like so many of us did back in the 50s and 60s, what is a logical progression for becoming an actual, honest-to-God, blue-water cruising sailor? So, if you're interested, I'll try to answer some of those questions here within the next half hour. Now, these are just my answers, okay? There's a lot of different ways to approach this subject, and there's a lot of different reasons to not approach this subject. But those of you who would consider, going out upon the big briny, let's talk about it. Okay, I don't mean to become too comprehensive about this subject, but I'd like to start out with a remark about the state of the world. I hear all kinds of stuff about, it's dangerous out there, and seasteading ain't like it used to be, and you can't do it anymore because there's just too many places that you can't go to. Well, I don't think that's true, particularly in a multi-hull. A shallow draft multi-hull, there's a whole lot of water that has not really been investigated thoroughly by cruisers, because most of them can't get into anything shallower than 6 or 8 feet. How about 2 or 3 feet? And as a matter of fact, because we are so flooded with information these days, we cannot help but gather the impression that the world is in a real mess. But actually, that's not true. We certainly have less serious war going on in the world than we did 40 or 50 years ago. And despite the terrible things we hear about the food shortages going on all over the world, it's true that before the Green Revolution in Asia, there were a hell of a lot more people going hungry than there are now. And even disease and pestilence, there's less pandemic problem, even despite the Ebola outbreak and stuff like that. We don't have hundreds of thousands of people dying from the flu, at least not at the moment. And while the employment situation in the United States is certainly not good, if you look at it from a global level, there's a whole lot more people today that have been able to earn their way out of poverty than there were 40 or 50 years ago. Or, for that matter, 1,000 years ago. Think of the predicament humanity was in 1,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, a lot worse. 3,000, 4,000 years ago, oh man, we were really looking at the issue of survival. Well, some of us think that we're looking at it again today, and who knows who's right. Certainly the chance for, drug-resistant pestilence or nuclear incineration is greater today than it has been. It looks like the Fukushima disaster in Japan may be literally killing the North Pacific Ocean. And there's a whole lot of bummer material out there if you want to just pick on that. But as far as going cruising, trying to get a feeling for how the world works, how things really are happening out there, well, now's just as good a time to do it as when Slocum did it. And if you want to try drawing a curve to represent the human condition and project that curve on out, it's not doing badly, in the long run, we can feel, I think, pretty confident about the survival of humanity unless things really go wrong. And they might. I'm not saying they will, but if they do, it seems to me that, as a matter of fact, I hope the hell they don't, but if they do, a cruising sailboat might not be a bad thing to have tied up at your dock or wherever you keep it. If we take a close look at things like the climate and the population level and the atmosphere and the hydrosphere, the biosphere, the lithosphere, all of them are beginning to look rather used up. So this curve of the human condition may indeed be bouncing off the top of the graph paper And, you know, all the Fed can do about it is tweak the interest rate, and who knows what's going to happen. And I'm not predicting anything. But I do know that for some of us, there was a lot of comfort to be taken from the ownership of a seaworthy, seagoing vessel. And for this quest of seasteading, it seems to me that a multi-hull would be a good vessel of choice for that application. Maybe we can talk about which one later if we have time. And I, for one, like to think that now's just as good a time to do it as ever before. Maybe better. The real problem is that we've all become so fat from comfort and convenience. And the techiness and yachtiness of all the doodad dilly-bobbies from the yachty shoppy, you know, you can really do without that stuff. You just have to get your mind in the same frame as the people who went cruising before it all existed. Like, couldn't you really go cruising without refrigeration? I don't know. It seems to me you can get ice practically every place you go, and if you can't get it, you can do without it. Would you consider going cruising without an inboard engine? You know, maybe an outboard would push your boat around in the harbor just fine. But now you got to have a boat under you, one that really sails and one that you know how to really sail. Would you consider going cruising without a shortwave, long-range radio? Well, it can be done, believe me. And if you cut way down on all of the electrical claptrap, it means you don't have to have an acre of solar panels and hundreds of pounds of batteries and the wind generator howling away on the stern. I mean, if you just decide not to buy into all of that stuff that Dick Newick used to call modern inconveniences, it just might make the difference between being able to go and not being able to go. And there are a lot of serious cruisers who think that all of that stuff does not add to the cruising experience on a subjective level. It doesn't have a lot to do with what happens to your head as a result of this incredibly intense exposure of contending with the ocean and then having your destinations separated by that ocean. All the better to perceive, to comprehend, to apprehend the contrasts between the destinations themselves. I think that's the real motive for going out there on the big briny, getting on in one place and getting off somewhere else. One of the big items that people really get exercised about seems to be food. People think that, you know, the United States is the only place in the world where you can get anything to eat. Anywhere you go that there's people, there's going to be food. People have to eat. It may not be the same food that you're accustomed to eating at home. In fact, it probably won't be. But any place that you'd like to go, I think you can still find plenty to eat. Of course, you can take a lot of stuff with you, stock up your boat, rice, beans, pasta, and flour. And then there's all the stuff that comes in bags and boxes and bottles and cans. And incidentally, I think that's the basic way to divide your stores so that you can find them. The bags and boxes on the port side and the bottles and cans on the other side. Right there you have a basic division that will cut in half the problems of trying to find what you're looking for when you're fixing a meal. And of course there's a lot of stuff like milk and meat that we tend to assume must be refrigerated, but that's not the case anymore. You can get permanent milk in little boxes, and you can get permanent meat in those wonderful aluminum pouches. And of course you can get carried away with all those backpackers meals, you know, instant freeze-dried stuff and so on. But generally speaking, you don't need it. You can go ashore and shop, and shopping is quite an experience sometimes. You have to go all over town to get 5 items. And it's just like getting ice. I finally put myself in a headspace that said, I've got to go get ice, and it's going to be a cultural and linguistic experience, and you can go get ice. And if you have your own refrigeration, you don't have that cultural and linguistic experience. When it comes to gathering your own food from the sea, of course, but there's a lot of knowledge involved. I mean, a good fisherman doesn't happen all at once. And I personally think one must be very careful about the local people. It's their fish, you know, and if you're busting in on their shellfish grounds or their ability to trap or net by doing it yourself, I don't know. I like to get my seafood from the locals. You can often trade them for something that they need and you've got, and they've got the seafood and you need it. But offshore, fishing where there's no one else around, of course, man. And it'll be the finest seafood you ever eat, especially if you do not have refrigeration, because that means you have to eat it all now before it spoils. And when it's right out of the water, it'll ruin you for seafood in any other degree of freshness. Before it ever hits the ice is the time to eat seafood, in my firmly held opinion. Of course, for a lot of would-be ocean sailors, the big stumbling block is money. If you're a regular workaday dude, there's no doubt it's harder to accumulate a cruising fund today than it used to be. If you can finance your sailing out of your IRA, good. But if you've blown your IRA by buying or building a boat, then you haven't got any money to go anywhere. Which certainly does argue for a smaller, simpler, cheaper sailboat. But how about working along the way? Well, again, this may be more difficult now than it used to be, but I've seen a lot of pretty inventive schemes for people to sustain themselves underway. One of them is to occasionally charter the boat, which means that you have to wrap your head around the notion of contending with a thundering herd coming through your home every so often. Some people love the social contact, others wouldn't think of it. If you're just doing day sails, it's not so bad, and quite often you can pull that off under the radar. That is, without work permits and licenses and all that stuff. You can also do work for other people on their boats. Particularly if you've built your boat, you're going to be a pretty handy guy, and you can fix not only your own boat, but other people's boats. You have to carry a few tools and some materials, perhaps. And if you've done your own canvas work on board, such as cushions, covers, even sails, and you wish to bring your sewing machine along and some materials, you can often do that kind of work for other boats in the harbor. Of course, the best thing is to have some kind of skill, some gig that is needed universally. A couple of examples would be, well, Mark Hassel, I've told you about his boat being struck by lightning out in the Pacific, and they're ending up at a little island called Kosrae for a year, while he fixed all the electrical stuff on the island, and they even gave him a job teaching in the high school. While he was able to fix up his boat, it had holes blown in the sides of it by lightning, and get going again. Or our late great friend Jerry DeRush, who was a physical therapist at home, managed to find himself in U.S. territories out in the Pacific, and he went ashore at Pango Pango, got himself a job in the local hospital, built up his cruising fund. Of course, we have become so very accustomed to what we call security that in order to shove off into the world and just make it on your own is unthinkable to many of us. But I'm just here to say that wherever you go, people eat, people work, people need help. You can also get help. Medical, dental, boat repair, all that stuff is often available within a few days' sail of where you might decide you need it. The reality is that wherever you go and try to work, you're going to be competing with the locals, and there may be all kinds of regulations, some of which can be ducked, particularly if you've made some local friends. But the essence is that wherever you go, you'd better have something that's needed, and that can either be money or skill. Or equipment. The boat itself can be your meal ticket. Now, I don't mean to encourage people to throw themselves to the mercy of the winds without having their act together. Seasteading is not to be done irresponsibly, but there's real truth in Sterling Hayden's statement that a voyage, like a life, should be based on a firm foundation of financial unrest. I think that's true because that's where the life is. That's why one goes cruising, is to expose oneself to that close-to-the-bone reality, which has become so obscure with all of our multimedia virtual reality. and the rampant phoniness of our organization world. Now, I think most people who would contemplate undertaking this sort of lifestyle these days have had at least some sailing experience. I suppose it's possible, but simply by listening to some loudmouth podcaster, one decides to go off and be a pirate. But please believe me, that's not the point here. Back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of my clients were absolute lubberly greenhorns. But they were in that can-do generation, felt invincible. And some of them, I suppose it's fair to say many, did indeed become real water people. But as I've described in some of these capers, you know, it's quite possible for one to get his mind fried out there for lack of previous experience. So I always advise my clients, if they would buy a set of plans for one of my ocean cruising sailboats, I did my best. I don't know to what extent I was successful, but I did my best to convince them that they really should build the dinghy first. And it should be a sailing dinghy, and they should spend time in that dinghy while building the big boat. Of course, it also helps to sail with others, particularly if the others are doing a little informal racing. I'm no fan of racing as a mindset, but you can sure learn to sail fast if you're with a racing crew. Of course, there are a lot of things about cruising that racing sailors don't know. Many of them have never dropped an anchor or would have no idea of how to troll for pelagic fish under sail. For that, they can come sailing with you later. So, of course, the first step in the progression to becoming a seasteader is to get some sailing experience. You need sea time in order to understand what the problems are. And in the process of coming to that understanding, you're probably going to have to permit yourself the opportunity to get cold, tired, hungry, wet, seasick, and scared. So this is not all peaches and cream, and it is rarely relaxing. It can be hard work, it can be expensive, and it for sure takes time away from other things. Lots of time. And if you have a family, of course, they either have to go along or they have to be comfortable with you being away. And by taking time away from other things, it may be that that time is irreplaceable. That is, one might return from, you know, years of cruising and find himself or herself to be a stranger in his own land and thrown off of the wheel of his profession. So unless seasteading is undertaken in the retirement years, there's no doubt that it can have a profound influence on one's career. And whether by rank rationalization or outright acceptance of the consequences, I think the main obstacle to the cruising lifestyle is just a matter of mindset. Well, okay, let's say you've made your mind up. You're going to go do this, and you're going to do it well. And it's finally time for you to get yourself a boat. And boy, these days there's plenty of them around, plenty of really well-built, well-found cruising sailboats hanging out at the dock just begging for new ownership. It's like going to the pound. So these days, if you're going to buy a boat, you can afford to be a real bottom feeder. If you choose the usual sort of production single-hull vessel, you can probably expect to get a hold of a good one for, who knows what, 10%, 20% of its so-called replacement cost. Now, you might also expect to have to invest something like its purchase price again in getting her fixed up and really ready to go. And for that much money, maybe you could build yourself a boat. Well, consider that it's a lot more expensive to buy materials today than it used to be. The good thing about building your own is that you can pay as you go, but you're paying just the same. And unless you're an experienced boat builder or a really handy guy, there's a good chance that you'll end up with something that you can't get your money out of, and that's the case with all boats these days anyway. So again, the focus shifts from the objective to the subjective. You're not investing in your boat, you're investing in yourself, and what you want to do with yourself and your life and your time. So let's say you get yourself a nice boat, and before you leave, you sell your house or your business or whatever it is in order to have the money to really travel, and you go do that. When you come back, you haven't really got anything tangible to show for it. It's like your house and your business are gone. Now, a real sailor man can bring his boat back in looking better and sailing better than when he took it out, even after years of heavy service. And that's worth something. It may not be worth much in this economy, in this yacht market, but a boat with a lot of miles under her, some real experience, some real development, a boat that's really dialed in as an implement, a highly specialized workboat, can be worth more than a boat that's been sitting at the dock and primped up in a boatyard every spring. But still, you're not doing this to make money. You may be able to make money with what you've learned. But those who succeed at ocean sailing often feel that that period of their lives was by far the most interesting and fun and formative and educational, developmental, changing, maturing portion of their lives relative to any other. Would they do it again? Not necessarily, but they sure are glad they did it when they did. Let's go back and speak a bit about the boat itself. Of course, a walk through a marina or through the pages of a boating magazine will convince anyone that there's an enormous variety of watercraft out there. They all seem to work. They've probably all got something wrong with them, some sort of shortcoming. And boat design really is a study in compromise. And after studying those compromises, starting early in monohulls, some of them great big ones, and then going on to a career in multi-hull design, you know, what would be my compromise? Well, for what it's worth, I suggest you have a close look at those Sea Clipper trimarans designed by John Marples. Okay, here they go, I can hear you say. Here come the snake oil salesmen. And it's true. Now, John Marples and I came together back in the Sea Runner days. Gee whiz, very early 60s. We've each had a rather wide experience with multi-hull design, both recreational and commercial vessels. So our opinions, our compromises, might be worth a little something. So after all the Sea Runner design and construction, we concluded that it was time for something a whole lot simpler and cheaper. I took a crack at the first one, the Sea Clipper 28. My gosh, I guess it was in the late 1970s. I thought of it as the biggest multi-hull you could trailer. The first one was built by John Perring in Canada, and it worked out very well. He trailered it all over the East Coast and sailed it all over the East Coast. Had a rather good fun with it. It was tight for living aboard. The main difference in the Sea Clippers relative to the Sea Runners is that the hull forms are much simpler, and they do not have wings overhanging the water. That is, the bunk spaces and wing storage compartments are not appendages to the hull. For the most part, they're contained within the hull. In the larger Sea Clippers now, of course, you can have wings. There's an option in the plans for building out over the water. But it turns out that it's right there, that step, that extra curve, as the hull topside comes up under the wing and then turns outboard in order to provide volume in the hull, right in there is where the work and the money and the grief begins to add up. For all the trouble it takes to do that, we just decided it was easier and cheaper and better in the long run to make the boat bigger, longer, so that you had more hull to put your stuff in. And of course, the bigger the boat, especially if you can get up over 40 feet or so, it makes really an enormous difference in how hard you get kicked in the ass by every wave. There's something to be said for ultimate safety in true storm conditions and so on. Some people feel that a larger boat is safer. I'm not convinced, but the real difference in a larger boat is riding motion. And if you're really going to ride, if you're going to go someplace, boy, there's nothing like a pretty big multi-hull under you for comfort underway. So John Marples has really taken this ball and run with it. There are now 11 designs in the series. They run all the way from 10 feet to 43 feet, is it? I think the largest one is 43 or 44 feet. And a few years ago, we did the Sea Clipper 20. And for that, we devised a folding system for trailering. It's based on the old swing wing idea, but this arrangement was so very much simpler than other multi-hull folding systems. And I'll be darned, it's worked out very well to the point where John has put it into many of the pre-existing Sea Clipper designs. So even some of the big ones now can be folded for trailering or for storing in a boatyard or your backyard, wherever the real estate might be of more value if it wasn't covered with a sprawling boat. Now, these vessels are not intended to be Yahtzee. There's nothing wrong with doing a nice clean job on them, but we discourage the impulse to improvise, to cutesify, to fancify the thing. These boats are implements, not works of art. They're designed to be rugged enough to knock 'em around. So I'm just saying, if I were to contemplate building a serious cruising type seafaring vessel these days, I'd have a close look at that Sea Clipper series. You can find it online by just going to searunner.com. Well, let's say that's enough propaganda for the day. And you know what they say about propaganda, the best of it is true. But the way things are going these days, who knows where the truth is, huh? So I'm intentionally leaving us just as adrift as when we came in, but perhaps just a little more realistic about this notion of seasteading, sustaining oneself with and from his or her boat. It's a rather elevated quest, really. It takes a lot of judgment. I hope you found some of that judgment here, and I hope you'll come back for more. Next month, that's March 2017, I really am going off, try to do some field interviews with other people who have opinions on this subject. If you have an opinion, please let me know. We'd like to get you in on this, okay? Bye-bye.